As mentioned, this morning we were given a wonderful foundation to think about the work ahead of us, and this afternoon we're going to try to look at particular ways of moving forward. And to do that, we've scheduled a couple short stories about congregations' work on this as well, some thoughts about a larger vision, and to imagine reparative possibilities that that go beyond that in Elkhart County. And so I've been asked to start by telling a little bit about assembly story here, and I just want to say it's not a story about, hey folks, here's how to do it right. We're still learning, we're still on the way. The vision for where we may go is something bigger and wider than what we're doing at Assembly. But I will provide you with a short story titled, How My Congregation Came to Pay Reparations. For decades, members at Assembly Church did what other congregations do to be informed participants in God's liberating justice. You know, we heard peace and justice sermons, we attended informative events, we sometimes spoke out politically, and we read books together. A lot of good, useful books. And then came the summer of 2020. We were social distancing and in front of the video screen, and we saw the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officer, and the murder of Breonna Taylor, and so many more videos of killings of unarmed black people. And we were shocked, probably more than we should have been. But we also felt convicted that our arm's length, no cost response to date was woefully insufficient. So we formed what was called an anti-racism accountability group for interested white people in the congregation. And this came out of an awareness of our tendency to engage anti-racism work for a while and then get distracted and move on to something else. We were looking for a way to break that pattern. The format of this accountability group was for individuals to share what concrete anti-racism action they wanted to engage in, be a part of, and then each month reflect with the group about how that went and say what follow-up or next step they intended the following month. That format was a simple way of providing members both accountability for what they said they would do and group encouragement to keep at it. Out of those monthly meetings came the idea to take seriously this century-long call from the black community for reparations and to think about how we, as a little congregation in Goshen, Indiana, could meaningfully respond. Reparations, we learned, and as we were reminded of this morning, is a call that dates back centuries. And one of the places it dates back to is the Reverend Garrison Frazier speaking on behalf of Southern white leaders who, as Drew mentioned, told General William Sherman that newly freed slaves needed land to sustain themselves. And it's a call made as recent as when Nicole Hannah-Jones said in 2020 again, if black lives are to truly matter in America, we must move beyond slogans and symbolisms, for a truly great country does not ignore or excuse its sins. It confronts them and works to make them right. So, as I said this morning, confronting sin through repentance and repair is a Christian mandate. So after the idea was explored, and this idea about heeding the call in some way, as it was explored and developed in this anti-racism accountability group, it became congregational conversation. And in the end, the congregation decided to respond. And we do so by collecting payments every month from our fellow congregants in a spirit of reparations. And we disperse the money annually to initiatives and organizations led by local black and indigenous peoples. Now, some of the specifics of our initiatives have included the following. One is that we speak of payments rather than donations as a reminder that this is not works of charity. The violent theft of Black and Indigenous labor, land, and freedom for the benefit of white Americans left a debt, both moral and financial, and we're seeking to make payments on that. Second, we chose not to pay this debt through our general budget, although some congregations do that, but instead we collect payments during worship on the first Sunday of every month. We put a second basket up here on the offering table that Sunday, and the worship leader every month reminds us of our commitment by saying, on the first Sunday of the month, we have two baskets for offering, one for our regular offering, and one to make payments on the debt owed locally to Black and Indigenous persons for the immeasurable harm of white supremacy. We do this to help become more of who God created us to be, a community of repentance and repair. So we get that monthly reminder. Third, we've established a reparations committee to make our payments once a year to initiatives and organizations led by local Black and Indigenous peoples. Organizations that address harm caused by our white supremacist culture. And fourth, our payments are not earmarked for any particular projects. How the money is used is decided by recipients. There's no report or accounting required. And while we're open to building relationships with those who receive these payments, that too is not a requirement to receive our payment. There's more I could say, but that's a brief overview. The bulk of these payments have gone to the new community center in Elkhart, the Tolson Center, which is revitalizing a local African-American neighborhood devastated by past governmental policies of neglect, and to the Miami Tribe of Indians. But our dream has always been to be some part of something larger, a larger movement of churches who are working together to dismantle the legacy and culture of white supremacy. Rather than make reparation payments alone, we hope to do this alongside others in our county and beyond, because doing so will expand the support for restorative work being led by marginalized communities, and it will make, we hope, a strong witness that engaging in repentance and repair for the sins of white supremacy is simply what followers of Jesus do. Imagine if people started to associate repentance and repair for white supremacy with what Christians are about, rather than the regressive politics Christianity is currently known for.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for sharing Assembly's story. At this time, I should say Carl's full story is on the yellow piece of paper here. And I'm going to just highlight a few things now from the purple sheet here. We're calling this a key considerations document, which just lifts up some of the central themes that have emerged in both of our congregations as we've discerned our way around reparations. And we hope that it might be a helpful guide as you continue these conversations in your own congregations. The front side is mostly a summary of points that Carl already touched on, but I do want to underscore just that first point that when it comes to making a congregational commitment to this, there's no one model or way of doing this. Assembly collects this monthly, and it kind of keeps that in the forefront of their worship on a regular basis. At 8th Street Mennonite, we decided to integrate this into our budget. And we set a goal of budgeting 3% of our annual budget. So we began this year with 1.5%, and our intention is to scale that up over the next few years. In doing this, we were intentional in not placing reparations under our benevolences in our budget, but it is listed as a current liability akin to a loan or mortgage or some other debt that is owed. And so again, that just underscores what Carl has already said about the importance of tending language and terminology. So we tend to use the language reparative debt payment, again, which likens this to a bill owed rather than a gift given. And I think as we've talked about this, it is really hard to break out of that charity mindset where we're just writing another check and giving out of our generosity. So using the language of payments rather than donations is one way that we're working at making that internal shift. which I think gets to some of the spiritual work that really does undergird this. And so you can turn to the back page of the purple sheet, and we'll just briefly touch on those things. A book that was core to both of our congregations was Reparations, A Christian Call to Repentance and Repair by Duke Kwan and Gregory Thompson, and they write this: reparation requires us not simply to restructure our social worlds, but more fundamentally and perhaps more painfully to restructure our inner worlds as well. And so they then offer four practices that can help us with this inner restructuring. Their first one they talk about is cultivating a culture of vulnerability as we have these conversations around race and wealth and power. And I was thinking about this. I remembered once when Sunitha Millsaps was visiting our congregation to talk about this topic. And at some point, she just stopped us and said, "When you hear the word reparations, what emotions surface for you?" And she did not just want us to ponder that in our hearts. She really wanted us to trust each other enough to bring that to the surface and to name out loud. What are we feeling? Is it guilt? Is it defensiveness? Is it fear, frustration? And it wasn't a comfortable exercise necessarily, but it did feel like an important part of the process, right? Just learning to name our emotions as honestly as possible. Again, this gets to the social emotional work that Melinda was talking about, and like what specifically is at the root of the resistance we might be feeling, and to really kind of dig around and get curious about that together. The second practice is one that we've also touched on, examining our economic lives, both individually, as families, as a congregation, and just keep coming back to this question here: what is wealth? Why do we have it? Why do we have the amount of it that we do? And what does love ask us to do with it? And we just have to be willing to keep coming back to that question. The third practice relates to yielding control, which again, Kwan and Thompson suggest is the essence of reparations. Releasing control for white folks is about voluntarily giving up some of our power, the power to decide where money goes and how it is spent. It requires trusting leaders and organizations to use the funds in ways that best meet the needs of the community without requiring reporting and accounting, as Carl said. It's about, again, being open to relationships but not mandating them and expecting them of BIPOC leaders. Trevor Bechtel is a pastor in Ann Arbor, which they did a big experiment with reparations with a year-long focus. They generated, I think, $100,000. And as Trevor was reflecting on this process, he said this: "This experience highlighted how white culture can be compelled by a need to control, and how that desire can masquerade as a stewardship value for responsible spending. Control can come by asking so many questions that action never happens." I found that really helpful word for me and for our congregation, and just encourage us all to hold that in our awareness and to keep that impulse in check. And just recognizing that this really is spiritual work. One of the ways that our congregation is just beginning to work at this is by actually, through corporate prayer, we wrote a prayer that includes the line, "God, help us release the desire for control." We're just being that explicit that we need help in being liberated from some of this. And so you can see that full litany in the packet as well. We use that litany when we're focused on our reparative debt payments on the Sunday closest to Juneteenth and Indigenous Peoples Day. And then finally, the fourth practice is truth-telling. We've already talked a lot about that, but I would recommend to you the article by Kelly Brown Douglas that is referenced there from the Christian Century. I have just quoted that 1,000 times this fall because it just keeps coming back to this is the sacred work of our time. And continuing to go deeper into our local history, supporting projects like what happened on Benham West and the Potawatomi Miami Trail Marker, all of these things that memorialize our local history. And I'll just close by saying that for our congregation, doing a Trail of Death pilgrimage every couple years and inviting new people from our congregation, including our youth, to be part of that has been deeply formative for us. And so when we're in that area visiting the sites from the first 2 days of the 1838 removal, we're also learning the language of lament. And so that liturgy in your packet includes these words: "We remember you, we lament this trail of death, guide our feet, O Lord, on a trail of life." And so just in closing, I think that that really gets to the soul work in all of this, because we are committing to remembering, we lament, and we understand that's not the end of this work. We don't want to stay there. It's not the final destination, right? We want to walk a trail of life with our liberating God, taking concrete steps on the road of repair. And so Ben is going to come up, and he is going to help us think about how we can walk that road together.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ben Bauman. I'm one of the pastors at Walnut Hill Mennonite Church on the north side of Goshen, and I too have been on a journey of awakening to the truth of our history and what that means for me personally and for us as a community and as a nation. Really grateful to be here, to have all of you here as part of this conversation. The blue sheet in your packet is what we're going to primarily focus on for the next few minutes. To give a little bit of background on how we got here, there are a number of congregations and organizations in this area that are a part of the repair network of the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. That's a mouthful. But many of us know of Sarah Augustine and others and the work of trying to dismantle the doctrine of discovery among ourselves, our nation, our laws and policies. And 2 years ago, those congregations, instead of just working individually in their own congregation, said, let's start to collaborate and meet together and have these conversations. And so now about once every 2 months, there's a group of, 10 or so congregations, I think Friedenswald is MCC and Friedenswald are some organizations that come as well, to begin to collaborate and to have these conversations. And so from the article that Carl wrote and this group gathering, we wondered, okay, how do we broaden this, expand it beyond 8th Street and Assembly, who have done the bulk of kind of congregational work, and how do we now begin to collaborate and draw other folks into this? And so we kind of had a discussion as far as, do we just encourage others to do similar things to what Assembly and 8th Street have done, or is it time for us to kind of collaborate on some sort of joint fund? And so that is what we are proposing moving forward, is to collaborate on a joint fund, which we are calling the Reparations-Inspired Fund of Elkhart County. Probably partly in not wanting to call it reparations, because we don't know what it will do, but that is our hope, and it is the reparations movement that has inspired us to take this action. And also to recognize that there is an ongoing call for reparations at the federal level that we still need to work towards and still need to advocate for, but also, if the federal government is not doing what they're supposed to be doing, that doesn't mean that we can't also be doing the work that we need to be doing. We also called it draft, just because there's been some eyes have been on this, but a few, and we see this as an ongoing working document. And so let's start working our way through it. Again, we start with ongoing growth and learning. We do not assume to have everything figured out, and we do anticipate learning along the way that will require adjusting these guidelines. For the fund beginnings, just to recognize there's a little bit of history there. Some congregations have primarily come into this work through the repair network. Some have primarily come through in work with anti-racism and learning primarily of the harm that has been done to African American peoples. And of course, although these histories are unique in their own ways, it is white supremacy that links both indigenous and black reparative work. In the third paragraph, I will read, "This fund is one way to respond to the numerous ways in which wealth has been extracted from people of color. This began with stolen land and enslaved labor and continued with numerous other forms of harm. This wealth has primarily benefited white people. It is our hope that this fund will help predominantly white Christian congregations grow into their calling to be communities of repentance and repair. We believe that a cooperative fund of this sort, rather than having individual congregations, persons do their own smaller initiatives, will make this effort more sustainable, more impactful, and more of a witness to our community." Moving down fund holdings for this initial year, which would be 2026, we anticipate a local congregation, and for this year we have identified Assembly as the one that would be that local congregation to hold, receive and hold the funds. And that in the future we could explore other options, but we are trying to balance for any fund holder to have the easy and accessible giving, whether online or through check, but then also for distributing, we want reduced bureaucracy. We want to be able to get money out in a way that is helpful and efficient. So the timeline, the fund will be open to receiving payments throughout the calendar year. It is open to contributions from congregations, individuals, businesses, the city of Goshen, the city of Elkhart, and beyond. Who knows who will give to it? So we're seeing this as, we're launching it kind of as a community of congregations, but is certainly open to anyone and everyone to contribute towards. In January of each year, the full amount collected from the previous year will be split and released, with roughly half of the funds supporting Indigenous reparative work and half supporting Black reparative work. And we would expect the first distribution to take place in January of 2027. There is a backside. Of course, congregations are welcome to give any amount, but we are encouraging congregations to set aside at least 1-3% of their annual budget for this reparative fund. And we recognize, like 8th Street, it may be necessary to kind of work up to a higher percentage, increased percentage over a number of years. And again, in the spirit of reparations, contributions to the fund are generally considered a debt that is owed rather than an act of charity or donation. Advisory committee. This is our current thinking, and it's open to ongoing conversation. An advisory committee will be made up of one member from each participating congregation. A participating congregation is any congregation engaged in the work of anti-racism, anti-oppression, who sets aside at least 1% or equivalent of their annual budget for this fund. So again, that's recognizing that 8th Street, Walnut Hill, we've put it inside our budget. Assembly has it outside of their budget. There's different ways of doing that. The Repair Network Consortium of Elkhart County may name an additional 2 members, and the advisory committee will meet as needed to make decisions about the structure and function of this fund. And then, to get to that fourth point, to seek to minimize white control of this fund, we are proposing that the advisory committee will work to establish an Elkhart County-based disbursement committee made up entirely of BIPOC individuals. This disbursement committee would have full autonomy over the funds that are set aside for Black reparative work. That's that spirit of releasing, relinquishing. Criteria for fund recipients. Generally, the funds will be used to redress both past and ongoing harm from centuries of white supremacist policies and practices. The money will be used to support Indigenous and Black people, organizations, and movements in their work for self-determination, ending oppression, and repairing racial harm. And then the last piece, the fund recipients for the Indigenous reparative work would likely be informed by the relationships that numerous congregations and individuals in this area have established with the Miami and Potawatomi peoples, as well as connections through the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. Now, I recognize that since we are late in 2025, and if congregations go by calendar year for their budget, it will probably be difficult to get into the budget for the 2026 year. But again, to note that there are other ways to raise the funds, like assembly having something once a month, having a one-time fundraiser. If a congregational budget is $300,000, that's 1% of that is $3,000, and I know many of our predominantly white congregations can raise that in no time if it's something that we feel called to support. What immediate questions do you have about this fund proposal guidelines? Our hope and intention is to not get stuck in the complexity and the questions, but to have a tangible, doable way forward. And this is our hope.
Hi, Darren Short. I attend Berkey Avenue. Clearly, this is feels like it's a Mennonite-led initiative. Are there intentions of contacting other denominations? Because there will be other denominations and even churches who don't belong to a denomination that I think would support this.
Yes, certainly. For this, we did reach out to a few other than Mennonite congregations. We wanted to be a bit careful about how broadly we extended the invitation, wanting to create a safe space to have reparations conversation. Again, this is going to be an ongoing thing, and I would hope and expect that we can begin talking about this, maybe do a news article. There's other ways of kind of reaching out and saying, this is happening. We'd love for you to join us, participate. We're happy to come and share about it. So both and.
I recognize that the goal is congregational involvement at multiple churches, but you had also mentioned individuals being able to participate. Let's say if it's an individual who's here but is not from a Mennonite church. What is the mechanism that you're making available for individuals to do that? Is it like through a web-based donation system, or can you speak to how that's going to be implemented?
Yeah, so I think the two primary ways to give would be through Assembly's website, we're planning to have a website for the fund as well. You could give through the website, and there would be, you know, a drop-down reparations-inspired fund of Elkhart County, or you can send a check with that written in the memo line. So yes, certainly individuals are welcome to contribute towards the fund in that way.
I strongly affirm the advisory committee that's mentioned here, and my assumption is that you all have been in conversation with congregations like Shalom that have done this. And I'll just say for you all and for the room at large, I was on Shalom's advisory committee, and it was a beautiful work that we did. It was hard work, and part of the hard work was it was the language here that we had full autonomy over the funds set aside, and it was very nerve-wracking because we are used to white people not trusting us. And so it took well over a year for us to do the whole process of disbursement. And so just thinking in terms of the kind of caretaking that we were allowed to do for each other with this work and connecting with Black and Indigenous, we made the decision to include Indigenous siblings in the disbursement, and we were kind of nervous about that, and it was fine. But yeah, that part of it, that letting go, to expect that maybe people won't quite trust that that it's been let go. And in my experience of that was that it was, but along the way it was just like, you know, these white people gave us this money to do. and we took it very seriously, but we also wanted to be very careful about things like documentation and all of that.
Thank you, Regina, for sharing. And I'm hoping, I mean, so we have like the advisory committee and disbursement committee, and hopefully the advisory committee can take that whatever white emotion is coming, that the predominantly white advisory committee can be the one to deflect that and answer that and respond to that, so that the disbursement committee does have that freedom to say, yes, this is ours to do with it.
My wife often uses the word relationships, it's so good and enlightening to hear that we're coming into realizing what we, and I'm speaking more for the white person right now, we're coming to realize more that we owe this debt. But I still have the question about people coming together and becoming part of each other in order to understand how do indigenous descendants and how do black descendants feel about all of this? What do they say? And so that's that relationship thing. And I'm wondering if there are pockets where people are getting together to understand each other as this process goes along.
Do you want to respond to that, Nikisha? Is that great?
Thank you so much. That just sparked an idea, like as part of annually, I mean, not to keep adding more planning or event, but could there be an event where people from the congregations and people who have received money can come and fellowship together? Mm. The congregation, I think it's Portland Mennonite Mennonite Church, I believe they have a fund, and like people from those places are invited to come and speak, like, and so that the church knows what's going on. I think you kind of have to watch that a little bit, because that could be can also show up as a form of checking in on the people. But if it was really like a celebration on a regular basis, where nobody's really put on the spot and we're actually really getting to know each other, that might be a way to tend to the relational piece as well. Like, what would an annual reparations-inspired gala look like? I know I got the right dress already, but I'm just saying. I'm not looking for an excuse, but.
Thank you, Nikisha. And I'll just respond again. Like, we don't. What are the possibilities of this fund? What are the possibilities for relationships down the road? We don't know, but I think we are open to how healing may be surprising and wonderful for all of us in Elkhart County.
So I have a quick question it's not a quick question. That is, I may be able to ask it quickly, but it may not be answered quickly. I have a question about the advisory committee composition, and it's kind of in the vein of what George and Nikisha have been asking, and I'm asking it as a person of color who is in a predominantly white congregation. Is the hope that the advisory committee is made up of all white people? I mean, I'm asking about the kind of dynamics, the interracially dynamics. And let me just also be clear that part of the reason I'm asking about that is because there's also, I guess, part of the anti-racism work of Mennonites, there has been this thread since the mid-20th century of believing that interracial families are one way to do reparative work. Like, that's part of our inheritance. And so sometimes it can be easy to embark on this work in ways that unintentionally either erase that dynamic or leave some of us who embody those realities feeling like we need to sort of choose one. I mean, like I've been told, clearly, I choose to side with my mother's whiteness because I don't participate in a Black Mennonite congregation. Right? I mean, and maybe that's true. I guess I'm also just awkwardly naming the fact that as we start doing this work, there are going to be those kinds of conversations that also bubble to the surface how individual people make arrangements in their own lives and choices about their families.
Yeah.
So I'll circle back around. The original question is the vision that the advisory committee is made up of white people?
Thank you for the question, and thank you for sharing that. No, not necessarily. Our congregations are predominantly white, but there are certainly people of color in our congregations. So it is completely fine for folks, no matter how they identify racially, to be a part of that advisory committee. We also just wanted to recognize, I mean, with the disbursement committee, that having a white person in a BIPOC group changes the dynamics in a way that full autonomy I think would not be as genuine. But certainly, I don't want to create a white only space in that sort of sense. Whoever from a congregation can certainly be appointed into that advisory committee and is certainly welcome.
Barb Hassan again, kind of tied into that. What kind of process will the advisory committee look at to identify the folks on the disbursement committee?
Again, it will likely build upon relationships that a number of us currently have. I think there are wonderful people in this room that would be great people to tap. They have been important conversation partners for me, I know for my colleagues and others. So yeah, I don't know, is there a right way to do it? Probably not. We're gonna go into the messy work of what this is and try to do it with full integrity and love and gentleness that we can.
John Bushert, just could you say a bit about the composition of the disbursement committee and its assignment? It's not parallel. The two groups are very different in history and all kinds of other things. Why just the one focus of that group? Why the disbursement committee? Is BIPOC individuals responsible for just Black projects, if I may put it that way?
Right. No, I mean, we have separated
it does
out.
Say
I,
that?
Yeah. I think that is
did
us.
Did I misread it?
No, you read it right.
No, you're correct. I think that is us trying to wrestle with the uniqueness of the histories. Again, it is white supremacy that has created this history, but the indigenous experience has been largely a pushing to west of the Mississippi River, in which the Native American population is largely not present that stewarded this land for centuries, whereas the African American experience is different with the Great Migration moving up from the South and then being told that you can come here, but you can only live in a certain neighborhood and you can only take the worst jobs. And so I think we're trying to recognize and respond to what does it mean to respond locally here in Elkhart County, and then what does it look like to respond to indigenous work concerns based on how white supremacy has created different present realities. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't know if that's right, but that was, I would say, our thinking behind it. Maybe one more question, and then I'd like to keep us moving. And if there's no more, we can just keep moving. Oh, we had a question in the front. Yeah. Okay, so maybe two quick questions.
Yeah, I'm Grace Mishler. I've kind of navigated and around the Pure People's Campaign, Mennonite Action Movement, and Indivisible groups. And my heart is also seeing the call for volunteerism. Tolson Center, I just totally think is great. But I also think about the call, like we, in the Poor People's Campaign, we don't have hardly any black folks that are there. It's white. And I'm concerned about how the impact of Medicaid, Medicare, SNAP among the black community and the older people too, filling out the forms, going the intimidation that they may experience going to the local Social Security or Medicare. You know, how's that all working out? And I see many of us white folks could be helping to make sure that they are not left behind.
Thank you, Grace, for the question, and certainly important issues that you have raised. I don't think I'm prepared to answer that as it kind of relates to the fund guidelines, but thank you.
This has to do with the role of stories. We talk about repair and restoration and resurrection. And the Mennos have a history of peacemaking, conflict resolution, care fronting. I don't know if you remember Dave Augsburger. Anyway, my question is sometimes, how does this work and how does this feel? And is anybody telling stories about that part of it? Some of our families, siblings, you know, don't talk to each other because of that and this and that. And our church families are sometimes sort of similar. And I would just like, I mean, along with this, they're very different, the conflicts, but I would like to hear more stories, more sharing about how reconciliation works in these situations.
Great. Again, I don't think I'm prepared to answer that here in this context, but thank you, Anne, for bringing that. I do want to continue moving us forward, and very excited to welcome both Sunitha Millsaps and Nikisha Elena Alexis to the front here. We are honored to have them both here. They have been important conversations partners for me. I also recognize Charlie Walker in the back there as an important conversation partner for me with reparations. Charlie served with the What Happened at Benham West project, and was also one of the folks interviewed. I'll just say a little bit of an introduction about Nikisha and Sunitha. Nikisha is the Intercultural Competence and Undoing Racism Coordinator at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary. Nikisha was instrumental in the What Happened at Benham West project, which has blessed our community in so many ways. Thank you for that. There is both a documentary and a recent book. Be sure to get it. Nikisha is also serving as the board chair for the Tolson Center for Community Excellence. And of course, Nikisha is just an all-around incredible person. Thank you, Nikisha, for being here. And of course, with both of these women, there's way more that could be said about them. Sunitha Millsaps, many of us know, executive director of Mennonite Women USA, currently serving the city of Elkhart as the cemetery department head under the leadership of Mayor Rod Robertson. She has previously pastored Mennonite congregations for many years. She's the founder of BAPS, Black American Princesses, which is a mentoring program for young African-American females between the ages of 8 and 17. She is on the board member of Tolson Center, previously chaired it, right, for the Tolson Center as well. Many more things that we could say, and also such a wonderful and beautiful person. Thank you both for being here, and we look forward to hearing your thoughts moving forward, is what does it look like here in Elkhart County? Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. How is everybody feeling? You had lunch. Everybody's good. Nodding of the heads. Folks are still awake. I'm just going to invite, don't leave the room, but I'm going to invite everybody to stand up and just shake a little bit. This is a long session. You can touch your toes if you want to do yoga in the aisles. It's totally fine. Yes. Oh, look, everybody, okay. Everybody's awakening. It's like sleeping giants. And I'm actually going to let Sunitha start, and then I will fill in after her.
Hello, everybody. It is absolutely a blessing. And Drew, thank you so much for today. I'm going to tell you what I told some. I've preached many of those kind of messages that you said today. And my husband and I had a joke that said that he would be out in the, he would get the car running in case. In case, and so you were over, when I was sitting over there, I was saying, I think I better go get the car running. I might need to get him out of here real quick. So I thank you for that. I thank all of you for being willing to be in these very uncomfortable places. And that we're asking this of you in a time where our world is saying shut up and sit down. And so what we're really asking and calling of you now, the Mennonite Church as a whole, is to do what we've done throughout history. We have always pushed against the grain until that period in which we kind of just lived into whiteness, and it felt really good for a while. And now we're calling us back to who God has created us to be. And so I thank you all for being in this space, because there's something in your spirit that is saying, this is what God is asking of me today. And so I appreciate that of all of you who are here today. I want to share a couple of different ways in which, as we consider reparations and things that we can do, how it impacts and can impact our communities. First, on a very, very individual level, a friend of mine out of California told me about a way her and her husband, for years now, have supported families within their community. And then here in Elkhart, I've had friends, myself, my family, and I as well. If there is a family that is in need of any sort of support, there is a year to a year and a half, up to 2 year contract of how our families give direct money and payment to that family without saying what it has to be for, right? You know the family is in need. You understand that you have a privilege that right now they do not have. You promise to put that money in, whether it's an account, drop a check in the mail, whatever that may be, for that time limit that you have said that you would support that family. Of every family that I have been a part of or helped others be a part of, the impact of that family emotionally goes far, much farther than the actual payment itself. In every situation, those families would say, why me? Who does this? Right? Who does this? Why would they do this? Right? But then they take so seriously what that gift is. And they don't want to blow it. Right? They want to make sure that this is a gift, and they are able at the end to say to themselves, because they don't owe the person who have given them the money any kind of reporting back. Right? But they want to be able to say to themselves that I did well with what was given to me. And so if you want to know more about how those can happen and maybe something your family could do, please, please talk to me. I think it is phenomenal, and I'm just so grateful for my friend out in Pat out in California who brought this way of sharing our resources with the other. In recent, just this past summer, I applied for a reparations grant from the Shalom Group in Michigan. Received it for, I was running Goshen College's summer programming. And what we wanted to do was take some young African-American males to the Marine Biology Station in Florida, Long Key, Florida, right? When I found out Goshen College had one, I was sort of like, what the heck? Why ain't y'all telling anybody? But typical Mennonite, but yeah. And so really felt like when we got a chance to go down there and view it, like, oh my gosh, this could change some young people's lives. Many of our kids never get an opportunity, let alone to go to Florida, but to also see an ocean. And so with some community partners and some school teachers, we selected 12 young black males to go on this summer week. We have our camps at the college were 1 week. They would go for 1 week to Long Key, Florida, and stay at our marine biology station and be taught by our professor at the marine biology station. And it was phenomenal. Now, we started with 12. All of them couldn't pull it off. They didn't have to pay anything, but you are talking about young men who have never, and parents, who have never been invited into this kind of space. We had 9 up until the night before. We had tickets and everything for him. And his aunt, who was taking care of him, said he was literally in a panic that he would have to get on a plane. And he knew he couldn't swim, so I'm gonna drown in the ocean. Like, he literally went through this massive panic and he didn't make it. Of the other 8 that went, only 1 of the 8 knew how to swim. The majority of our children do not learn how to swim. Y'all may not know that, but that is true, right? The majority of them do not learn how to swim. We had young men that were 9th and 10th graders. They were going into the 9th and 10th grade, and only 1 of 8 knew how to swim, right? They were very scared of the fact that they had to go not only in the ocean, but they would have to be on boats that would take them farther out in the ocean. These young men, first of all, the professor said he was so proud of them. These young men worked really hard because we worked with the school, Elkhart Community Schools, to make sure they got science credit for their time at the program. But he said he was amazed by how they were focused. Like, they realized, oh, this is something big. They were interested. They were respectful. So everything you hear usually about our children, they defied every one of those stereotypes, all right? And my thing is, thank you. My thing is that what we keep doing to try to help our children are these big kind of, you got to do all of this over here. What it really takes is for us to get a few of them together and put some focus and attention on a few. You don't have to do anything so massive and so big. Take a few and put some real intention behind your interactions with them, and you can change. And I am 100% sure of those young men that we took, right? We will look back in the next 5 to 10 years, and they'll all be in college, right? They will all remember the time they got to go to the marine biology station and what happened with them there. They talk about their time together. They also said that they would have given the whole trip a 10, right? But one of the days they got stung by jellyfish while they were in the ocean. And so they had to take off points because they got stung by jellyfish. But they will never forget that. They will never forget that they had this opportunity. Everyone said they wanted to come back the next year. However, we won't be able to do that again next year, at least at this point. I don't know. Maybe I'll ask for a reparations fund grant again. this is important. This kind of work is so important for our communities. And just like the individual families that we help, just like the young men that went to the marine biology station, to be able to say that a Mennonite group did this for you. They don't have to know you by name. They don't have to see your face. But the fact that we are Mennonite and Anabaptist goes a long way. My community is still talking about Quakers and abolitionists, right? Right? We know who helped, okay? Right? We are still talking about them, right? So it's not about us individually, it's who we are collectively. The last piece I want to say about this, as we consider a fund, education is number one. And if you want to help our community, the Black community, the focus has to be on education. We have to start young, and we have to understand that our children are not being educated the way they need to be educated, that we've lost a generation of parents who also do not know how to support their kids, need support themselves. So really, as we consider reparations for our community, education has to be at the forefront. I am one that will continue to advocate for all Black elementary schools and money going towards historically Black colleges. If you want to have more conversation about what that means, that's just fine. But this, to me, is something we have no other choice to do in order to save the Black community. So thank you for considering us. Thank you for considering our stories. And thank you for getting in the fight. Thank you for being uncomfortable for a little while. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sunitha. And just to follow up on what she was saying, when I met with the organizers of the gathering, I just had a conversation with them. I really encourage them, and I'm going to encourage this room to really not underestimate the magnitude and revolutionary potential of this day, of this conversation. A lot of big, beautiful, dangerous, liberatory things happen in quiet, calm rooms like this. In every time, I think it has been difficult, clearly, to do this, but especially in this time, and I keep telling people, we are in a dictatorship. Are we there irrevocably? I don't think so. But anybody who thinks that that bus has not already left the station, we're here. Can it go back? Yes, it can, but not without people doing some things to the tires. So, so that this might be a tire doing moment. And partially why reparations is so important, and then I'll get into specific things, is like it's racism by economic warfare. Like this is what it is. It's not just that people don't like other people. I can deal with people not liking me. What is untenable is economics as the weapon. And I don't even call it white supremacy anymore. I call it delusions of white supremacy, because it's a delusional, you are not supreme. To go at it from a material fund, material perspective, it's not only biblical, it's not only that, but it is the appropriate response to what is being, to the an appropriate counter to what is being done. And because we're in a time when a lot of things are being divested from, where a lot of things, universities, colleges are being attacked economically, it is insanely important to have, it's not going to be the same response. We're not replacing the government, but wherever we can patch and make whole places where holes are being deliberately drilled, that's not a small thing. So I hope that we will look back on this day in the same way that everybody sings, "What is this place where we are meeting?" Right? Like that we will sing, "What was this place where we were meeting?" When this fund becomes bigger and bigger and greater and can do more things. So this is revolutionary stuff that we're involved in. Thank you all so much. There are a couple things. I have a couple things, places in that I could name, but really what I want to, I'm a strategic thinker. What I want to sort of encourage is some strategic relationships. because people like myself are not going to be around forever if we're thinking about this fund existing beyond particular personalities. What are the institutional relationships that this fund and the people who run it need to be in connection to? One of those I'm thinking about, especially in Elkhart, is the Chamber of Commerce, currently run by LaVon Johnson, who is the grandson of the family that was the last family, I think, to have their house torn down in Benham West, and whose family was one to fight a legal fight to try to keep their home, and it was then taken through eminent domain. So his work there is professional. He's very good at what he does. It's also very deeply rooted in his family history. There are minority business. They just had a minority business award ceremony where they were recognizing different minority businesses. So having that connection could put you in conversation for the future with minority businesses that might need startup funds, that might need support getting equipment and such. I was just at a redevelopment, so let's start there. So the Chamber of Commerce in Goshen and in Elkhart, you want to be thinking about how you can be in conversation there to see what kind of minority business initiatives are going on a regular basis for that. The Chamber of Commerce in Elkhart is also, along with the City of Elkhart, the major driver of, with the Mayor of Elkhart, I'll say, the major driver for the revitalization of the Benham West neighborhood that is a 20-year at minimum plan. There are a lot of pieces of that, of course, that are financial pieces. I have heard multiple times that current state legislation, which is basically gutting a lot of the municipal tax collection base, like there's basic stuff that's going to be hard to do with the Senate bill that's in there, much less over and above stuff for particular communities who need financial support. I would invite people to keep an eye on that plan. I am currently serving as the community liaison for the MACOG. It's a very long acronym, but it has to do with the community of government in this area. The environmental cleanup for the roundhouse site where the trains were alone is a multi-million-dollar project. There are so many toxins within that area of the earth, and trying to figure out how to repurpose that for redevelopment is going to be incredibly expensive. So being in conversation with LaVon and the Chamber around that plan specifically and how can private donations be given towards some of this stuff? Would it go to MACOG? Would it go to the Chamber? Can certain things be earmarked to help with cleanup and revitalization? That's going to be a real tangible thing that will need to be dealt with. So I see that restoration of a neighborhood that was torn down and not replaced. If anybody is not familiar with the Benham West story, please ask me. But for those of you who know it, that's not charity. It's a long overdue, again, debt that should have been taken care of. So that would be, I think, an ideal place for reparative funds to go into. I'm just going to, so there's that. What else? Other relationships. Pay attention. I have always thought this, so I'm just going to put it in here. Your city council makes all sorts of decisions in empty rooms. Your redevelopment commission is making a lot of important decisions in empty rooms. I happened to be at the Board of Zoning Appeals meeting because of some other development that's going to be happening in my neighborhood. I'd never been to that meeting before, but I got a letter in the mail and happened to be there at the same time when a young woman who has been operating daycares out of South Bend, she's an African-American woman, she's moving to Elkhart, they're taking over the old Burton's Laundry site. She has to do all sorts of things now to with zoning that she didn't realize that she needs to do. And while I was sitting there, I was just thinking, like, this is probably going to add to her costs. Like, she was there with her architects and such, needed to get some zoning appeals to be able to make that daycare friendly. I got her information and things like that, right? But I was just thinking, like, wow, if she has to move the playground and put the thing there and it's going to take longer and these are the architects, like, that's actually going to cost more. I would not have known about her if I didn't happen to go to that Board of Zoning Appeals meeting. So I don't know if there's some way to build into the process that somebody from the advisory committee, or it's rotated through the advisory committee, that you stay in touch with what's happening in your government, because a lot of big decisions, and their economic decisions, are being decided there, and there's nobody there often to speak up for or against it. And so the status quo usually is what happens. Which brings me to conflict of interest hat. It's red, it's on. I'm on the board of Tolson. Yes, I am. But I'm going to advocate for them too, because had I not been at a city council meeting trying to argue against luxury apartments, I would never have found out that Tolson Center was going to be defunded. That is a stroke of God, because that was going to be my last city council meeting. They voted to move ahead with the luxury apartments, and I happened to stay to the end because I wanted them to see my face the whole time till the end of the meeting. And Tonda Hines got up at the end of that meeting at the public of the floor, and she said, please do not defund the Tolson Center. And instead of that being my last city council meeting, I ended up fighting for a few years, and now I'm in my second term on the board and the board chair. So thank you. So I have a special love in my heart for Tolson. Tolson currently is the anchor for the redevelopment of that neighborhood. There are other businesses, housing. It's not like there's a vacuum there, right? Like, there are other people who are a part of that neighborhood. At the same time, from an institutional perspective, Tolson is one of the biggest drivers of the change that's happening and is touching a lot of different lives in a lot of different ways. And so we are currently, to put it in terms of numbers, I believe we currently receive about $700,000 of support from the city every year. We were able to negotiate that was locked in. And I know that there are people who are chomping at the bit for that 10 years to be up, because it's not guaranteed money after that. And so we are currently in our second year. We're getting into our second year. In 8 years, that money's gonna disappear, and we're gonna have to figure out how to get $700,000 annually replacing that money. That's not a small feat. We're working at it. We're working at it against with a lot of support, but also still with naysaying. Like, the amount of fights that sometimes we see on social media and the negativity that we have to get through, that affects our ability to get donors. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right, yes. Just to make the operations. So it's a massive lift, and we're working at it, and it's a massive ask. While I have the microphone, I'm gonna make sure that I don't have anything else that I want, anything anywhere else to point you to. The last thing too is last two that I'll say very briefly. One is related to the Benham West and the Benham East redevelopment. Housing is going to be a huge piece of that. There is so much infill housing that is not, like, so many gaps, holes in between housing. And so there are going to be people that are wanting to do small business, small home development. There's going to be people that need to repair their homes. The chamber, again, is another part of that. They're wanting to create some ways to train people in housing upkeep, and also providing tangible funds for people to train their to upkeep their homes. And the last thing I'll say, too, is that really this is a big opportunity to get to know your Black Christian neighbors in the churches of the city of Elkhart. I think sometimes it can be easy to give institutionally to institutionally, but there are people with congregational buildings that need repair. There are people with long roots in the city of Elkhart who, you know, are their congregations are also struggling with numbers and upkeep and mortgages and such. So as you're thinking about who money can go to, please consider that there are African-American churches, Black churches right next door, that church-to-church help might also be of assistance. So thank you all so much.
Thank you, Sunitha and Nikisha. Also want to introduce and hear a bit from Luke Gasho. He's the former director of Mary Lee Environmental Learning Center, a longtime board member on the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery, a historian regarding local indigenous history. He's been giving leadership to the Potawatomi Miami Trail Marker Group and has an impressive edible forest in South Goshen. So welcome, Luke.
This has been a great time of gathering together, and yes, the edible forest actually has a connection, because when you get your hands in the soil, it changes how you think about all of the topics we've been referencing today. So today we're sitting in a building that's on incredible soil land of the Elkhart Prairie, a 10,000 acre prairie that was the food system for the Potawatomi, the Miami, and Woodlands people before them for many, many centuries. And so recognizing the impact of settlers on this landscape is one of the things to work on. I've been grateful to be part of the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery since its inception in 2014. We didn't have the name yet back then, but it's been good to see the results of reparative actions that have been generated by the coalition here on Turtle Island, as a result of the coalition's vision. One of the features that emerged a couple of years ago after our initial work was mostly with individuals interested in this work of dismantling the doctrine of discovery, especially related to indigenous people, was to form repair networks, repair commitments with congregations and organizations. And so that's part of what's behind our gathering today. Multiple congregations represented in this room have officially joined the repair networks and responded to their call. This is a commitment to work on both cultural and structural change, which, again, in all of the areas that we're talking about today, whether it's related to indigenous people, African American people, or the extractive actions toward the earth itself, it takes both cultural and structural change to work on that. After recognizing that within this region we have multiple congregations and organizations that have a connection to the coalition, that's when we began this consortium of repair network members, where we meet every 2 months. And so our meeting today has grown out of that work, as you've heard as well. It's been helpful for us to meet every 2 months, to hear from each other, to encourage each other in the work and the journey that is not always easy, but is also very much a part of our passion to do. One of the things that the consortium has also been able to do is to have members of the consortium sponsor various activities where other congregations and organizations are invited. So listening to Sarah Augustine, for example, a Tewa woman who's the executive director of the coalition, Jared Naley, who's from the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, George Godfrey, Potawatomi, member of Citizen Potawatomi Nation, Wenzler Noise, Apache Stronghold leader, as well as doing advocacy work, and there's a lot more advocacy work to be done. I'm grateful for how various groups within our region have worked on providing learning experiences. Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary with its course that will be offered again this year, which is the pilgrimage along the Trail of Death that the Citizen Potawatomi Nation members were part of back in 1838. So having those kind of learning experiences, clearly very helpful. We also are grateful for the other learning experiences regionally related to the Trail of Death, or visits to Potawatomi and Miami places here in northern Indiana, and making connections, attending powwows, et cetera. I'm thankful for places like Camp Friedenswald, who very intentionally has reached out to the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi and built relationships there, but then also developing curriculum for campers and attendees to understand the stories connected to the land in deeper ways and more authentic ways than previously, which includes taking a trail hike through the property and understanding that on that trail hike, you cross where a very ancient trail of the indigenous people existed. Members of the consortium have also joined working groups within the coalition to work on solidarity issues. So two in particular, one is the Apache Stronghold with Oak Flat. Many of you are aware of that work. If not, look that up on the coalition's website. A more recent work that began officially this fall is standing in solidarity and self-determination with the Shinnecock Nation on Long Island. And so that relationship is developing with intentionality of listening for what their needs are and how we can be with them as we seek their self-determination and justice-related issues. One of the things that we've also, a number of us have worked on that has related to the coalition, and Ben mentioned this, is recognizing that where we are sitting today, just about a little over 400 feet to the east of us, this major trail between Fort Wayne and Chicago Pass, and most people aren't aware of that. And so as you come in the building out here, you see a sign that's a result of this Potawatomi-Miami Trail Markers group, and that's a continued work that's going on. And Drew, that fits into what you were talking about, on-ramping. It's a way of helping people understand a history that isn't necessarily threatening to anyone, which includes the fact that we were able to work with our senator to the state house and have him, Blake Dorio, take a resolution to the state house, which was passed regarding this trail and its historicity, which gives some additional leverage as we continue this work of marking this trail, bringing that awareness into the northern Indiana region. So there's a lot of ongoing work that we're involved in, but again, I think this intersection that we're talking about today of these threefold major impacts resulting from the doctrine of discovery are very important for us to work on together. May we continue to be encouraging to each other.
We will take a brief break soon, and then please come back. We will end with a panel conversation with Drew, Nikisha, and myself, emceed, hosted by Carl. If you got an email from me yesterday, then you I have your contact information. If you did not receive an email from me yesterday,